content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 25, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Our 100th year remains the little thumbprint corner in the top right hand. The cover today features a young woman, blonde, with long blonde tresses, greenish eyes. She's smiling somewhat into the camera. She's wearing a glittery green dress with some type of sequin interwoven in the fabric, large voluminous sleeves, otherwise sleek fitting. She is Kelsey Ballerini. By Shania Twan, plus 99 more of the world's rising stars. We'll begin today with the brief, Testing a City of Migrants, by Sonia Mansour. New York struggles to accommodate tens of thousands of migrants bused from other states. And this photo on the cover page of this article shows a group of young men, about six. They're dressed very casually. They seem to be queued up for some reason. There's a building behind them, but there's no signage on it. These are young men of color. One is leaning over and leaning onto the fencing device that keeps the queue in place. They're just regular-looking people, but they're somehow in a group in front of a non-identified building. Al Sayed, a father of six, tries to quickly change direction when his children hear the sound of an ice cream truck coming down on New York City street. He cannot afford it. In Afghanistan, life was good and they were eating everything, says Sayed, who was a civil engineer before the Taliban's 2021 takeover. He fled with his family, first to Brazil, then across the southern border into the U.S., an epical journey that landed him not only in a new land, but also in its politics. Sayed is among more than 100,000 migrants who have arrived in New York City over the past year. It is an influx that threatens to overwhelm the carrying capacity of a city that has made opening its arms to newcomers so fundamental to its identity, see the Statue of Liberty, that southern and southwestern governors set out to test it, busing tens of thousands of newly arrived migrants from Texas, Florida, and Arizona to 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, the Port Authority bus terminal. Never in my life have I had a problem that I did not see an ending to. I do not see an ending to this, Mayor Eric Adams told a gathering September 6. This issue will destroy New York City. In a nation of immigrants, New York may qualify as the capital. Almost 40% of its 8.4 million residents were born in another country. Two-thirds of the population in its five boroughs are either immigrants themselves or the children of immigrants. But the pace at which the recent migrants have arrived, deliberately intended to stress test the safety net and assumptions of a Democratic stronghold is unprecedented. New York City's right to shelter law means officials cannot legally turn away anyone seeking shelter, but the city and state have been fighting in court over the best way to house the migrants. The city sued more than 30 New York counties for issuing emergency executive orders meant to ban the city from arranging asylum seekers to stay in private hotels in their jurisdictions. Syed is staying at the Roosevelt, which is a designated arrival center, in addition to functioning as a shelter, but getting the space required, waiting in line for 10 hours at a stretch for 2 days. He's so nervous about losing it, he asks that his name not be published. Syed, S-A-Y-Y-I-D, is a pseudonym. In June, as those shelters neared capacity, the city created 206 emergency shelters, including so-called respite centers in school gymnasiums and parking lots. Many are bare-bones spaces providing little more than cots and a few meals. The respite centers are at the bottom of the barrel, says Mahmoud Mahmoudi, co-founder of EV Loves NYC, a nonprofit focused on food insecurity. Because they're not permanent shelters, rules on cot spacing and the number of bathrooms per people can be overlooked, he says. Then there's the ice cream truck. Without jobs, the newcomers not only cannot afford treats for the kids, they're also not going to be able to afford a place to live. So, advocates, migrants, and New York politicians are increasingly focused on the kludgy process for getting federal work permits. Migrants need to wait 180 days or 6 months after filing for asylum to qualify for a work permit, and those requests are taking about 2 months to process, according to a Department of Homeland Security, DHS, official. We need the federal government to allow asylum seekers to work so they can provide for themselves and their families, says Adams. Governor Kathy Hochul has said something similar. But the Biden administration has recommended that New York improve its end of the process. The waiting period for work permits is meant to discourage misuse by those without credible asylum claims. And DHS notes that because the 180 days is written into the statute, the agency does not have control over it. Congress does. Many on the other side of the issue argue that allowing migrants to work would incentivize crossing outside the legal process. Some migrants resort to working cash jobs in construction or delivery, but Syed says he won't. If the police found out, it could tank his asylum case. I will not put my family at risk, he says. A loose web of nonprofits and aid groups has developed to help migrants with everything from basic necessities like food, bedding, socks, and hygiene kits to legal advice. EV Loves NYC says it delivers about 2,000 meals across the city on Sundays. Syed relies on the group for halal meals. Power Malu, an organizer from the aid group, artists, athletes, activists, sets up every Friday at a church in Midtown Manhattan, where volunteers, including city employees helping in their free time, legal aid attorneys, and bilingual English teachers, gather to address the gaps in caseworker and legal services. But the issues of work and housing persist. On a recent Friday, three men from Mauritania wait at the church to connect with a volunteer attorney. El Khalil Mohammed Selma, 24, says he's been staying at a respite center for almost 2 months. The security talks with us like we're animals, says we're strangers in this country, Selma says. Every day, he and the other two men go try and find work. Every day, they come back without a job. Next is a captioned photograph. Well, it looks like a big white globe in a black background. The white globe has gray splotches on it. It also looks as if something's bitten a few pieces from the bottom edge. There are silhouettes of two humans also standing on these bitten out pieces on the bottom edge. And the caption reads, "Once in a big blue moon." A blue supermoon captivated stargazers worldwide August 30, including these hikers atop Piestewa Peak in Phoenix. Balloon-like supermoons are common, appearing larger because the full moon is at its closest approach to Earth. But blue moons, the second full moon within a month, are rarities. So blue supermoons can go as much as 20 years between occurrences. So the photo is depicting a big blue supermoon. From the bulletin, the staggering economic impact of Taylor Swift's Eras, E-R-A-S, tour, written by Mariah Espada and Jeannie Kopstein. There is a photograph, a partial shot of a young woman. Apparently it's Taylor Swift. It's not captioned, but it's a young blonde woman dressed in kind of a fluffy pink outfit, holding a microphone to her mouth in her right hand, and each of the fingernails on that right hand is painted a different color. You don't have to be a Swiftie to have been touched by Taylor Swift's Eras tour, which kicked off in March and ended its first U.S. leg August 9. The tour, which pays homage to every era of the artist's 17-year career, is set to become the biggest of all time, a third of the way through its run. Analysts estimate ticket sales will hit $1 billion in March, surpassing the current record holder, Elton John's Farewell Tour, on its way to a projected gross of $2.2 billion in North American ticket sales alone. The money goes far deeper than ticket sales. The Eras tour is projected to generate close to $5 billion in consumer spending in the U.S. alone, with fans dropping an estimated $1,300 to $1,500 on ancillary local spending for things like outfits, dining, and travel. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker credited Swift with reviving the state's tourism industry after three nights in Chicago. World leaders from Chile to Canada have courted her to come through. Swift's fans line up for hours to snag exclusive tour merchandise and clamor to get their hands on physical copies of her music, even in the digital age. She accounted for every 25th vinyl record sold in 2022, boosted by reissues, extras, and releasing various editions. The Eras tour likely owes a measure of its success to its post-pandemic timing and the itch of concert-goers for an immersive live music experience. But its unmatched triumph is of a piece with the career it both celebrates and amplifies. Swift is uniquely connected to her body of work, writing all of her songs, fiercely protecting her music in the streaming boom, and re-recording her discography to reclaim the master rights. The latest recording is due in October, as is a theatrical film of the concert. But the power of the tour, which has dates across five continents, scheduled through late 2024, is driven by her extraordinary connection to her fans. From the brief news, good question, what is Florida's hurricane tax? By Alejandro de la Garza. In Florida, it will not be just those homes and businesses hit by Hurricane Idalia whose people might be stuck picking up the pieces. Thanks to a broken home insurance market, a particularly bad hurricane could spread financial fallout throughout the state, leaving residents from Pensacola to Key West paying repair bills for years. Beset by hurricanes made more severe and more frequent by climate change, as well as rampant fraud and tides of frivolous lawsuits, dozens of insurers in the state have closed up shop or stopped selling new home insurance policies in recent years. Farmers became the most recent big insurer to pull out of the state in July. Residents have increasingly turned to Citizens Property Insurance Corporation, a public entity established by the Florida government as the state's so-called insurer of last resort for people unable to find affordable rates from private insurers. But for many, Citizens is becoming the first and only option, especially for those with coastal homes at particular risk from hurricanes. In 2019, Citizens had about 400,000 home insurance policies on its books. Today, it has more than 1.3 million, about twice as many as the state's next largest insurer. With so many homeowners using Citizens policies, each hurricane season becomes a financial roll of the dice for almost every Floridian. When a normal insurance company takes big losses, it goes bankrupt. But if hurricane winds destroy too many homes covered by Citizens policies, and the insurer faces bigger bills than it can afford to pay, the public company will not go belly up. Instead, such an event can trigger what is known as an assessment, wherein state law mandates Citizens imposes fees on private insurance policies across the state in order to cover its payouts. And it is not just property insurance policyholders that may have to pull out the checkbook. If you live in Florida and have auto insurance but cannot afford to own a home, you can still be stuck contributing to funds that pay for homeowners to rebuild after a big storm. We have many low-income households that are literally living paycheck to paycheck, says Mark Friedlander, a spokesperson for the Insurance Information Institute, a trade group. They cannot afford this. That situation last occurred after the storms of the 2004-2005 hurricane season, which had Florida residents paying off Citizens' $1.7 billion tab through 2015. Currently, the insurer has about $4.8 billion in the bank. It is unlikely Idalia's effects will break that budget, but months remain in the Atlantic hurricane season, and the increasingly warm waters offshore can serve as fuel for powerful storms. We probably only need one or two more hurricanes to make landfall before Citizens has to do an assessment, says Charles Nice, NYCE, a professor of risk management and insurance at Florida State University. When you have 1.3 million policyholders, that $4.8 billion is going to go very quickly. There is no easy solution. Laws passed in the Florida legislature last year have cut down on some of the fraud and excessive legal filings that had been choking the state's private insurers, and Citizens is trying to offload some of its bloated policy roster to the private market. But other forces are pushing in the wrong direction. One reason Citizens is flooded with policies is that it is legally barred from raising rates fast enough to stay in line with sharp increases on the private market. The Florida state government recently rejected a request from Citizens Management to impose a 12.1% rate hike. That decision may keep prices lower for policyholders, but ultimately could cost more residents in the longer term. As Friedlander puts it, it is a recipe for a hurricane tax that would be applied to all Florida consumers. There is a small photo here. It's in color, but it's rather dreary looking in grays and blues. It's a canal, the blue part, in Horseshoe Beach, Florida, riddled with debris after Hurricane Idalia in August. Now, on the left side of the canal, there are a few houses, large multi-story houses that appear to be intact. On the right-hand side of the canal is a grassy area, perhaps with a picnic shelter or some other outdoor roof on stilts is what it looks like, roof on posts. But the canal itself is full of junk, debris, as the caption reads, and it looks like a mess. Moving now to milestones. There are four, five died, one filed, one considering, one fired, one booked. Beginning with the booked column, this is by Nick Popley. Donald Trump, a not guilty plea. There is a photo of a frowning Mr. Trump here. It's just a small headshot. There are a lot of firsts when it comes to Donald Trump. The first president to be impeached twice, the first former president to be indicted on federal charges, and most recently, the first former president to have a mugshot taken. Oh, this photo may be the mugshot. He's shown here with very light, bright, silvery blonde hair. He's frowning, grimacing, actually, but it shows that he's wearing a dark blue jacket, a white shirt, and a red tie. The world has seen hundreds of thousands of pictures of Trump over the decades, but the image released by Georgia authorities August 24, after he was booked on more than a dozen felony counts, may be the most famous of all. Platinum blonde, cotton candy wisp of hair shimmering in the harsh jailhouse lighting. Eyes locked in a hard stare. The historic image immediately generated attention around the world from both detractors and supporters, becoming a political talking point that has so far resonated with Republican voters. Days later, August 31, Trump pleaded not guilty to charges related to his alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election loss in Georgia. Fannie Willis, the Fulton County District Attorney, charged Trump with 13 counts, including violating state racketeering laws and soliciting a public official to violate his oath of office, conspiring to commit forgery in the first degree, conspiring to file false documents, and making false statements. Trump has now been charged in four separate criminal cases related to his business and political activities, bringing his total criminal charges to date to 91. The cases in New York, Florida, Washington, D.C., and Georgia are expected to play out over the coming months, setting up a long string of legal battles that will overlap with next year's presidential primaries as he runs to retake the White House. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan set the date for trial on four federal charges in a Washington case for March 4. The day before Super Tuesday. fired the coach of Spain's women's soccer team, Jorge Vilda, September 5, days after the Spanish Football Federation's president was suspended after forcibly kissing a player on the mouth. Considering a name change from India to Bharat, B-H-A-R-A-T, by Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government, which replaced the nation's name on dinner invitations sent to guests at the G20 summit. Filed, singer Joe Jonas of Jonas Brothers and DNCE for divorce from Game of Thrones actor Sophie Turner, September 5, after 4 years of marriage. They have 2 children, ages 3 and 1. Died, former Energy Secretary, UN Ambassador, and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, at 75, September 1. Steve Harwell also died. Steve Harwell, former lead singer of Smash Mouth, at 56 on September 4. Died Samuel Joseph Wurzelbacher, who became known as Joe the Plumber, after asking then-candidate Barack Obama about tax policy during the 2008 presidential campaign at 49, August 27. Died Jimmy Buffett, laid-back superstar. This small column was written by Stephanie Zakarik. There is a photo of Jimmy Buffett. He's singing. He's got a microphone in front of his face. He's got fluffy blonde hair, not quite shoulder length, facial hair. He has his mouth open, so I think he's singing, but he could also be smiling. Very large sunglasses reflecting light. A cap of some kind, but his head's tipped back, so I can only describe it as being a dark-colored cap with a brim. He has a blue shirt on, a blue T-shirt. He's holding his brownish-colored guitar. The T-shirt has some sort of an caricature on it. It looks like a bird flapping its wings. And he's wearing a pendant that features an anchor. If you had to assign a color to Jimmy Buffett's perennial laid-back sound, it would be a vivid Caribbean blue, the hue of a tropical sky and sea merged into one breezy swirl. Buffett, who died September 1 at age 76, was not just a singer-songwriter. He was a vibe, one that millions of fans warmed to. But if his biggest hit, the 1977 Margaritaville, spoke of a boozy, barefoot, carefree lifestyle, there was nothing lackadaisical about his business sense. His numerous ventures, including Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville restaurant chain, made him a very rich man, though in real life he knew when to abandon the heavy-duty partying. By the late 1980s, he had turned to writing books, 3 of which, beginning with 1989's Tales from Margaritaville, became #1 bestsellers. Not bad for an artist who made a name for himself by spinning dreams of lounging around Key West, fruity drink in hand. His legacy represents hope for unambitious people everywhere. And the final entry from the Milestones Died column, this features a really broadly smiling young-looking man with dark brown hair combed back from his face. It's a black and white photo, so we see a dark suit and a white shirt and a dark tie and arms crossed over his chest. Bob Barker, enduring host. It was only fitting that the longest-running game show in North America, The Price is Right, was home to the host who became synonymous with television longevity. Bob Barker, who helmed the CBS show from 1972 to 2007 and died August 26 at 99. Television came into Barker's life in the 1950s, when, after making a name for himself in radio, he hosted his first game show, Truth or Consequences, an NBC fixture that dated from 1940. He hosted it until the mid-1970s, even as it coincided with the dawn of his The Price is Right era. Following his retirement from The Price is Right in 2007, Barker focused on animal rights activism, a cause he had embraced for decades and championed on air. In 2015, he returned to The Price is Right as an April Fool's joke, thrilling audiences. "I know the world's full of fools," he said at the time, "but I am a carefully selected fool, and it is a pleasure to be with you." And that column was written by Mahita Gajanyan. The brief, business, economy. "Small grocers are hurting. My buying habits don't help," by Alana Samuels. There's a photo here. It's a parking lot, essentially. But there's a building in the background, and it says Walmart on it. And above and beyond it are blue skies with white clouds, and the caption reads, "A Walmart store in San Leandro, California, in August." Every week I go on to Walmart's website and order a bunch of groceries to be delivered to my house, and then feel a little bit guilty. By shopping at Walmart, I'm likely contributing to the demise of the independently owned grocery store, which is disappearing across the country. But the prices make the choice easy. On a recent day, a 42-ounce tub of Quaker Oats was $9.99 at Key Foods and $5.68 at Walmart. A 500 ml bottle of California Olive Ranch olive oil was $14.49 versus $8.37. And Rao's, R-A-O-S, homemade tomato sauce was $9.99 versus $6.88. These prices are one major reason Walmart captures 1 in 4 grocery dollars in America. That may not last. These days, the U.S. government appears ready to listen to the argument that Walmart and other big chains, including Dollar General, which is expanding at a rapid clip across the country, come by those prices unfairly because of their market power. There's a law on the books, 1936's Robinson-Patman Act, that essentially says suppliers in any industry cannot give lower prices and special deals to big chain stores if it costs the same to serve them as other stores. The law also says retailers cannot bully suppliers into giving those discounts. But because Walmart and dollar stores are so huge, representing a big part of a supplier's business, they are able to extract deals and low prices from suppliers, according to Small Business Rising and the Main Street Competition Coalition, two groups of independent business owners making their case in congressional hearings and television ads. It is not just groceries. Independent pharmacies, bookstores, auto parts stores, and other types of retailers are also struggling on an uneven playing field, they say. Walmart's leverage may seem like a good deal for consumers like me. In an era of runaway inflation, who doesn't want the lowest prices they can get? But the rise of Walmart does indeed contribute to the demise of independent stores, the grocers say. Since suppliers lose money by giving discounts to stores like Walmart, they increase the prices they charge other stores, a phenomenon economists call the waterbed effect. The higher-priced stores struggle, lose customers, and go out of business. Then the big box stores, their dominance established, and their competitors wiped out, raise prices. During the pandemic, that meant consumers living in lower-income areas far from big-box stores were not able to get the groceries they needed. Everyone deserves access to healthy foods and eating options, says Letitia Brunson, a councilwoman in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where a grocery store closed in November 2022. Her ward does still have dollar stores with shelf staple products, but now residents cannot shop for fresh food without a car. Neither Walmart, Dollar General, nor Dollar Tree, which also owns Family Dollar, returned a request for comment. For a long time, from when it was passed until the late 1960s, Robinson Patman was a prime enforcement priority of the Federal Trade Commission, says John Kirkwood, an antitrust expert at Seattle University School of Law. But the field of antitrust underwent a populist revolution starting in the late 1960s and 1970s, in which academics, lawyers, and eventually judges decided it was more important to prioritize consumer welfare than small businesses. A 1969 report by Ralph Nader excoriated the FTC for protecting small businesses, arguing that doing so drove up prices for consumers. In the wake of this populist push, the FTC and Justice Department slowed the pace of bringing Robinson-Patman cases. Those they did bring were less and less successful, until it became extremely difficult to win one, says Kirkwood, who was the lead counsel on one such case filed by the FTC in 1988. But today the argument that big chains need to be reined in is regaining traction with the FTC. Under Chair Lena Khan, appointed in 2021, the FTC has embarked on an aggressive path of antitrust enforcement. In March, Khan said the agency wanted to bring more cases under the law in short order. Meanwhile, FTC Commissioner Alvaro Bedoya has embarked on a national listening tour, meeting with independent grocery stores and pharmacy operators and talking about how Robinson-Patman enforcement could help them thrive. I do think the corporate power in this country is such that slowly folks, no matter what their politics are starting to say this is too much, Bedoya told a room of people in July as he visited Oasis, an independent grocery store that opened in 2021 in North Tulsa, Oklahoma. After the city passed an ordinance limiting the proliferation of dollar stores, my hope is that 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, there will be bipartisan agreement that we need to work harder to protect small businesses like Oasis. That government officials are standing up for independent businesses represents a sea change in how we think about what is good and bad for the U.S. shopper. For decades, the FTC and Justice Department have focused antitrust enforcement on protecting consumers from monopolies that can drive up prices, concluding that if shoppers are getting a good deal, there's no reason for the government to step in. Enforcing Robinson-Patman means the government would focus less on whether I'm getting a good deal on groceries and more on whether the fabric of my community is better off with the status quo. The biggest grocery stores and box stores are not evenly distributed around the country. They tend to be clumped in more affluent suburban areas, says Bedoya. Rural and urban areas are disproportionately served by independent grocers, and they go out of business when dollar and big box stores come in and undercut those grocers on price. A Walmart located in the suburbs, even if it is just 8 or 9 miles from a city center, is not a good solution for neighborhoods where people do not have cars or access to consistent public transit. what you are left with is some of the poorest people in the country. Some of the people in the most underserved areas are left without a place to buy fresh groceries, or just groceries, period, Bedoya says. Of course, it makes some sense today. Walmart would get lower prices from a cereal company or juice seller. It is ordering huge amounts of product, and that sheer volume creates efficiencies that arguably save suppliers money. But the grocers are arguing Walmart and big boxes are not actually creating efficiencies while still using their size to extract deals. Instead of waiting for the FTC to act, many independent grocers have banded together into cooperatives, so they will have more bargaining power. Those giant co-ops buy billions of dollars of groceries and have warehouses all around the country, just like Walmart does. Associated Wholesale Grocers, for instance, is a food co-op that serves 3,400 member supermarkets, representing $24 billion in sales. By contrast, there are 4,631 Walmarts in the U.S. AWG buys goods by the truckload rather than the case, so a supplier sends a truck to its warehouse in the same way it would send a truck to Walmart, says David Smith, AWG's president and chief executive officer. Smith, who grew up in the grocery business, says back in the 1970s, when Robinson-Patman was enforced, suppliers would issue rate cards to tell grocery stores how much an item cost. The amount on the card depended on how much the stores bought. A case, a pallet, and a full truckload of a product would all have different rates. But after three decades of Walmart growing and gaining market power, he says, now there is no transparency whatsoever. And what is happening is efficiency being surpassed by leverage. Walmart now accounts for 25% of all groceries purchased, compared with around 10% at competitors like Kroger and Costco, says Jason Goldberg, Chief Commerce Strategy Officer at Publicis Group. According to AWG, it stores average about 35,000 square feet. The average Walmart is around 110,000 square feet, says Goldberg. So the latter inevitably buys more product overall, leading to better prices offered to the bigger buyers. Indeed, suppliers have not issued list prices to retailers in decades, Goldberg says. Instead, they sit down with retailers and negotiate prices along with joint marketing spending and product placement. Deals are very hard to compare because they have so many moving parts, but one thing's for sure, the retailers with the least leverage are going to pay the most, he says, and the biggest retailers with the most leverage are going to pay the least. The grocers say the discounts Walmart gets are not commensurate with the efficiencies the company creates. Many store owners have experiences like that of R.F. Bush, B-U-C-H-E, who owns 23 independent grocery, convenience, and hardware stores in South Dakota. He will sometimes walk into a Walmart and see lower prices on the shelves than he can get wholesale through AWG. In December, for instance, Walmart was selling a dozen eggs for $2.27 when he was buying them for $3. Walmart was selling iceberg lettuce for $1.88 a head when he was getting it for $4.46. My customers just do not understand when they look at my shelf price and Walmart's shelf price, says Bush. He had to sell three stores since 2019 because it was impossible to keep them afloat. Suppliers' allegiance to Walmart solidified during the pandemic, says Bush and other grocers. Because Walmart makes up such a big share of a supplier's business, they could demand on-time delivery, even during the pandemic when everything was running late. In September 2020, Walmart told suppliers they needed to be making on-time and in-full shipments 98% of the time or face steep fines. As a result, suppliers shifted whatever they had available to Walmart. Bush and other independent grocers, on the other hand, could not get the items their customers needed, so the customers switched over to the big box stores. Suppliers mince no words explaining how dependent they are on Walmart. In regulatory filings, giants like Kraft Heinz and Nestle mention Walmart by name, explaining that consolidation in grocery has led to retailers with increased purchasing power, and that those retailers can demand lower pricing and more favorable terms. There are industry watchers who say enforcement of Robinson-Patman would result in higher prices for consumers. By enforcing the law, said former FTC Commissioner Joshua Wright at a Cato Institute event in 2022, the government would not be prioritizing consumer welfare, but would be instead just assuming big is bad. That's a real question for consumers, whether the FTC's enforcement of Robinson-Patman could drive prices up. Economists are still divided. Some studies show enforcement would drive up prices. Others suggest it would not. If the FTC can somehow prove enforcement will not raise consumer costs and will instead create a country with big chain stores and small independents with similar prices, it may have a fighting chance at restarting enforcement after more than 30 years, but it's going to be an uphill battle. Any cases filed under Robinson-Patman will likely eventually end up in appeals court, and maybe even the Supreme Court, and both are likely to take a dim view of it because they're so conservative, says Kirkwood. You would have to go up against these judges who think it's the left-wing FTC trying to revive the Robinson-Patman Act, he says. I like the idea of shopping at the independents after all, but my pocketbook vastly prefers the cheap prices at Walmart. I suppose I should be willing to pay a little more so that Americans living far from a big box store can also get fresh groceries. But it is hard to volunteer to pay higher prices on behalf of an unknown fellow citizen. In the meantime, Walmart is gaining even more leverage when people like me decide to shop there, making the independents' fight for equal prices even harder. The brief, Health, Five Red Flags for Online Mental Health Content, by Angela Haupt. The classic vision of therapy revolved around a person on a couch, soupin', tapping into their deepest and darkest hopes and fears to a seated guy with a beard. A modern-day remix might look like this, still on a couch, but at home, scrolling through a constantly refreshing selection of mental health content on social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram. Though it may feel therapeutic, experts advise proceeding with caution. As an increasing number of psychologists step into the role of mental health influencer, opening the door to fame and financial incentives, their posts are reaching millions of people. It can be difficult to suss out which so-called experts are credible and whether their information is trustworthy, risking misinformation and harmful misunderstandings. If your algorithm is feeding your mental health content, keep an eye out for these red flags. 1. The person running the account does not share their credentials. Most credible mental health influencers will be transparent about their training, licensure, and areas of expertise. Victoria Reardon, an Ohio-based licensed professional clinical counselor, suggests checking the account's bio. That's where many practitioners specify whether they are, for example, a psychiatrist, a social worker, or something that perhaps does not require specific training or regulation, like a life coach. If you're not seeing much information, search the person's name online. If they're legitimate, they're going to come up on Psychology Today, LinkedIn, or their own private practice website, Reardon says. Two, they're trying to sell you something. It's natural for psychologists to utilize their social media platforms to promote things like online courses and books they have written, notes Genesis Games, a psychotherapist in Miami. But if all their content leads you back to their storefront, that means they are more concerned about making you their customer than providing quality education, she says. There's a difference between saying these things are resources and posting exclusively to hawk products. Three, posts are jargon heavy. Therapy speak is infiltrating everyday language. Molly Spiesman, a licensed clinical social worker in New York City, cautions social media users to keep an eye out for accounts that turn these types of therapy terms, like boundaries, into buzzwords. Trustworthy practitioners typically are not using therapy terms and therapy jargon because they want to make therapy and mental health more approachable and digestible, she says. Four, practitioners promote self-diagnosis. A rule of thumb from Spiesman. Never diagnose yourself or others. Social media is often fixated on labels. If you do these five things, you're depressed, or you're a narcissist, or have ADHD, or are on the autism spectrum. What I notice with clients and friends is that people internalize these messages so deeply, and they do diagnose themselves, Spiesman says. They'll see something on TikTok and be like, oh, I have this issue, or my partner has that. She now spends time in sessions asking clients to take a step back and reflect on why a specific post resonated with them so much. Five, they tout one modality as superior to all others. Therapists are typically trained in a number of different modalities, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, eye movement desensitization, and reprocessing, EMDR, gestalt therapy, and art therapy. They might specialize in and even prefer one, but they should not be touting it online as the end-all, be-all, Games says. Not one single therapeutic modality works for everyone, she stresses. It is not one size fits all. Here are two entries from the 99 World's Rising Stars. This is in the Advocates column. Abeba Birhana, Checking the Data by Margaret Mitchell. A-B-E-B-A-B-I-R-H-A-N-E. And I will condense both of these. Mitchell's the chief AI ethics scientist at Hugging Face. Shining light on toxic patterns in AI is not for the faint of heart. The realities of racism, misogyny, and hate that underlie modern advances in technology are difficult to face, let alone address. Yet Abeba Birhana fearlessly dives deep, critically analyzing AI databases, models, and culture to unearth fundamental problems in today's systems. Dr. Birhana's groundbreaking research has articulated how beliefs and values affect whom technology serves and whom it harms. She stays focused on the people behind each data point AI learns from and has been key in pinpointing the problem of digital colonialism, including the exploitative technology practices in her native continent of Africa. Dylan Brandt, DYLANBRANDT. 17, Triumphant Plaintiff, by Miss Major Griffin Gracie. Miss Major is an activist and founder of House of GG in Little Rock, Arkansas. I met Dylan Brandt at the courthouse in 2021 when he first challenged Arkansas's ridiculous law banning gender-affirming care for trans kids. He was so kind, despite what he was going through at the time. The way things are in this world, it is hard to grow up and be your true self. We have to bend here and bow there. But Dylan is a young man who knows how to fight. People will always remember he fought for trans kids in Arkansas, and in June of this year won a landmark victory when a federal judge struck down the ban on gender-affirming care. Hopefully his success encourages other folks across the U.S. to stand up and fight against all of the continued bull SH space T that the transgender community has to deal with. Now, Dylan deserves to have peace, quiet, and enjoyment, and a long and happy life. I love him so much, and I wish him well. If he's ever in Little Rock, he's always welcome at the Oasis. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.